We begin Acts 27. I want to put it in context. First of all, we can look at the larger story of Acts, and in the larger story of Acts, this is Paul's fourth and final missionary journey, though unlike previous missionary journeys, he is making this one as a prisoner. Nevertheless, he is going to redeem this time to share the gospel just as he has on his planned journeys. From the divine perspective, we see it as the fulfillment of Jesus' words to Paul in Jerusalem, as recorded in Acts 23:11, where Jesus appeared to Paul and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." Now, since his capture in Jerusalem, Paul had been sent to Caesarea, where he'd spent about 2 years. And Governor Festus, after getting some advice from King Herod Agrippa, ultimately sends Paul on to Rome. Now, both Festus and Agrippa believe that Paul is not guilty of any crime deserving Roman punishment, but the apostle has appealed to Caesar, and apparently he did so in such a way that he had to be sent to Rome. We can only wonder exactly what it was that they put in their letter that they sent, because remember, he had asked Agrippa to help him decide what he was to send to explain why Paul was going. And I wonder if he actually put in there that Paul really didn't seem guilty to him, but the Jews had forced his hand. Who knows? But somehow he sends Paul on to have his case heard before Caesar. And that's where we pick up the narrative in chapter 27. We'll begin working through that chapter tonight with just a two-part outline. First of all, Paul's voyage begins in verses 1 through 8, and Paul's warning ignored in verses 9 through 12. We begin, Paul's voyage begins, verse 1, "And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment." So Paul isn't making the journey to Rome alone. He's not making it overland. He's making it by sea. He's among a number of prisoners who the governor Festus is sending to Italy. And he entrusts them to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. Commentators believe that Luke shows honor to the centurion by telling us his name. Many times when a soldier is mentioned, we don't have his name. But this name, Julius, suggests that his family received citizenship under Julius Caesar or Augustus. And as we'll see, Julius shows some special favor to Paul during this journey, and it may be rooted in the nature of their shared citizenship. The Augustan regiment, of which Julius was a part, was composed of 600 Syrian soldiers under the governor's command. And so Governor Festus could call upon them at any time to do his bidding. And in this case, he is sending Paul and the others to Italy for their cases to be dealt with there. Verse 2, "So entering a ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us." Now, tonight you've got a map on the back of your bulletin that will be very helpful, because basically this passage is a travelogue of Paul's journey. So if you look in the lower right, you'll see that Caesarea is the starting point for this journey to Rome. It's in Caesarea that Paul had been held prisoner by Felix, subsequently by Festus, and it is from Caesarea that Paul is being sent out. Now, if you look in the sort of the middle of your map, you can see Ephesus there in Asia Minor. If you look north of Ephesus, you can find the town of Amadritium. And that apparently was the home port of the ship that's going to carry Paul and the other prisoners. And it seems that the centurion books passage on this particular ship as it begins its homeward journey. So this ship is ultimately going to go to Adramyttium. Now, that's not where Paul and the others are being taken, but they will go partway on this ship, and then they will shift to another. This is going to sail along the coast of Asia. I read in one book these ships were called coasters. They didn't go out in the big wide open sea, but they stayed along the coast. It was a smaller ship, likely, that was making this journey. Now, we're told that with Paul is Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. We've already read about him. Aristarchus was one of Paul's traveling companions. He was seized during the riot in Ephesus. Remember, they wanted to come after Paul. They couldn't find Paul, so they grabbed Aristarchus and Gaius and dragged them into the theater. Well, he was one of those who suffered under that riot. But he continued to accompany Paul after they left Ephesus. Now, in Colossians 4:10, Paul writes of Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner. Now, if this is the same Aristarchus, and we cannot be sure, it was not an uncommon name, then he may be among the prisoners aboard this ship. But the way Luke writes doesn't make that clear, and it may well be that Festus allowed him to accompany Paul on the voyage to Italy. Festus was rather favorable toward Paul himself, and it would not be unlikely. In fact, we're going to find there's another traveling companion that we haven't heard about yet, and so there was the opportunity for those. So either he's a fellow prisoner, or I think perhaps more likely he's simply accompanying Paul as he had in the past. But before moving to the next verse, note that how this one ends, with us. So who is writing this? Who's the author of Acts? Luke. So we're back to a time when Luke has rejoined Paul. So there's several of these us passages throughout Paul's journey. Those are the times when Luke was with Paul and he's writing as an eyewitness. And so he's giving an eyewitness testimony to the voyage that Paul is going to make as he is sent to Rome. And so he continues, speaking of we, verse 3, and the next day we landed at Sidon. And Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. So again, look at your map. You can see from Caesarea, it's just north up the coast to Sidon. I read that that's about 70 nautical miles. And it's a place that we know about from Scripture. After the martyrdom of Stephen, we know that Jewish Christians scattered in many places. And one of the regions they went to evangelize was this region where Sidon is located. Paul also spent time in Tyre, which is very near Sidon, on his way to Jerusalem. And given these facts, it's not surprising that he has friends there. Luke makes reference to friends, and these are almost certainly fellow Christians, that there was a church of some sort that existed there in Sidon. And in an act of kindness, Julius the centurion allows Paul to visit these friends and to receive care from them. This care may have been medical, financial, or could have taken the form of provisions for the journey. If you remember, as we've seen before, prisoners at this time were largely provided for by friends. The Romans didn't provide them all that they needed. Their friends would come that would bring them food, that would bring them clothing, that would bring them things. And Julius allows some of Paul's friends to do this during the journey, probably giving him things he needs that will make the journey more comfortable. Verse 4, when we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. So you can go from Sidon, you see they're going out in the Mediterranean Sea, and you'll see Cyprus. Remember, that was like the first stop on Paul's first missionary journey. Now, when Paul makes his missionary journeys on the second and third missionary journeys, he comes from the west back to the east, and he goes through the open Mediterranean Sea. He was taking larger ships to do that. This is a smaller ship. This is that coaster that sails along the coast. And so it's staying close. And strong winds are blowing from the west. And so the ship sailed to the east of the island of Cyprus so that they would be shielded from the winds for that portion of their journey. They would be safer hugging Cyprus than going out between Cyprus and Tarsus on the mainland. Then verses 5 and 6, and when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, those are two regions you can see on the map, to the port of Myra in the region of Lycia. So again, you follow the arrow from Cyprus. They actually land in Myra. It's near the city of Lycia. It was a good-sized port in southwestern Asia. We know that cargo vessels bearing Egyptian grain regularly docked at Myra before sailing to Italy. And it's likely that it is on one of these larger ships that Julius and his group find accommodation for the second portion of their journey. So their plan all along is to go along the coast to this larger port where larger ships are available that regularly sail to Rome. And so they get there, they find such an Alexandrian ship, and they are put on board. Verses 7 to 8. When we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. Passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. And again, if you look at your map, you can see that from Myra, they sail. They're off this little peninsula. This Cnidus is a peninsula there. And then they make their way towards Crete. But they're doing so very slowly. And that is because the ship is sailing into very strong winds. So it makes their progress very difficult. They're going much slower than they usually would do on this journey. And once again, we have a ship that is seeking shelter from the wind provided by an island. The first time, on the first ship, it was Cyprus. This time, it is the island of Crete. And so, with much difficulty and slowness, they make their way to Crete, and they make it to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. And you can see that there on the island of Crete, you see Lycia. That's near where the harbor was that was called Fair Havens. And despite its lovely name, it was a very small harbor that was exposed to the sea. And as we'll see, it's not the ideal place for a ship to anchor during the stormy winter at hand. But here, the ship stops at Fair Havens, and that sets the stage for the second half of our passage, which is Paul's warning ignored. So we read in verses 9 and 10, "Now when much time had been spent, and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, 'Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives.'" Now here we have a calendar reference. We're told that the fast was already over. Now you remember that Paul had been trying to get to Jerusalem in time for Passover. That's one of the feasts of Israel. But among the feasts of Israel, there was only one that involved fasting. And that was Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And that falls in late September or October. So knowing that the fast was already over likely puts us into October. And from mid-October on, the Romans referred to the Mediterranean Sea as Mare Clausum, which means closed sea. This time of the year, the sea was not considered navigable for most ships due to the storms that took place that season. So we've reached the time when most ships are not going to set sail for the Mediterranean. They're going to be in some place to weather the winter, to winter there. Now, the journey since Myra had taken longer than expected due to harsh weather. We're told much time had been spent. It was now that time of Mare Clausum because we're told sailing was now dangerous. And the normal course of action in this situation was to find a safe shelter for the ship to stay during the stormy winter months. It simply was not safe to be out on the sea, so they needed to find some place to anchor for the winter. Now, we've already noted that Fair Havens, despite its name, was less than an ideal place to do this. It was a small harbor, and it was very open to the sea. And so the wind and the waves could be a danger to ships that were anchored there. But Paul tells them, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with danger and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives." So Paul here is counseling that they don't try to go any further. They've made it this far in the midst of difficult weather, and he's suggesting that they stay there because the journeying on would lead to disaster. Now, some people think that Paul is making a divinely inspired prophecy here. I don't think that's the case for several reasons. First of all, he makes no such claim. In other places, he does. Even more so, the things he says don't all happen. If this were divinely inspired prophecy, it would happen. No, what it seems is that Paul is speaking from his own experience on the sea. Though Paul is not a trained sailor, the fact is that he has had a great deal of such experience. In his second letter to the Corinthians, and this was written before this time, so this all happened before what we're reading here, Paul wrote, 3 times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day I have been in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of the seas. Paul knew something about perils on the sea. Paul knew something about the danger of shipwreck. And so he spoke this warning as a seasoned veteran of the kind of disaster that could happen this time of year on the Mediterranean. Nevertheless, his warning is ignored. Verses 11 through 12. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. So the centurion, in his official capacity, seems to be the key decision maker here. There's a captain of the vessel, there's an owner of the ship that is there, but the centurion is the one who's going to make the decision to go on or not. Now, there's no doubt that the ship has to find safe harbor for the stormy season. There's not the question even of continuing on to Italy at this point. The only question is, where will they stay? And Paul, to whom Julius has shown some favor, believes they should stay put in Fair Havens. The helmsman and the owner of the ship, on the other hand, think they should move on to find a better harbor on Crete. And the decision made is reflected in Luke's summary statement. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. And so it seems that it was the unsuitability of Fair Havens as a winter harbor that carried the day. And it is true, from what we know, that Phoenix would be a better winter harbor for the ship, given its location. It was within a day's sailing to get there. The only question was whether they would get there, given the already difficult weather. Paul had warned against it, and you have to come back next week to find out what happens. Now, this is something of a bridge passage. It simply traces Paul's journey before more significant action takes place. There's not a lot to draw on by way of application. You're probably not going to be navigating first century ships in the Mediterranean Sea anytime soon. But I'm going to follow commentator Dennis Johnson to note one principle that I think we can take from this. And that is, we see in this situation the Apostle Paul has genuine concern for those around him, believers and unbelievers alike. Now, Paul knew that he himself was going to get to Rome. He had to. Jesus told him he was going to get to Rome. But he had no certainty about the others. And so he shows compassion and care for their well-being. And in this, he echoes the ministry of one like Joseph, who provided wisdom to save Egypt, a land of unbelief, from famine when he was in the service to Pharaoh. And I'll close with these words from Dennis Johnson. He writes of Paul, like Joseph in Egypt, he offered God-given wisdom for the benefit of his neighbors, whether Jewish, Christian, or pagan, as we are called to do, even in our spiritually compromised culture today. So at least one principle that we should have concern and care for those around us, not only spiritual care, but also physical care, as we have the opportunity and the ability to help them.